Welcome, Register Readers, to episode 17, I believe, of Semi-Coherent Computing. This is your host, Ashley Vance, and we're returning to a bit of a chat on the server and data center landscape with our longtime friend of the show, Chris Hipp, and also Dan Olds of Gabriel Consulting. Gentlemen, hello.
Howdy.
Hey, how you doing?
So we have a action-packed set of topics that we want to hit up here. I thought we might move away from all the interviews that we've been doing for the last few weeks and kind of dig back in to the big iron and the little iron and see what's going on in the market.
None of this software stuff matters without the hardware to run it.
That is right, my friend. And we'll leave those software Nancys somewhere else. There was, you know, just to jump right in, there was kind of one system that caught my eye the last couple of weeks, and that was IBM's iDataPlex box, which we wrote about on the Register. It's, you know, just briefly, it's kind of a cloud, it's IBM's answer for cloud computing, and they finally come out with kind of a custom design that they worked on for about 18 months, and more or less it marries two racks into one. But Dan, it seems like you've probably been closest to the actual system. IBM's information on their website is still a little sparse on this iDataPlex box, but maybe you could give us the skinny on what's really going on here.
Yeah, I was briefed in about a year ago, but was out in Raleigh for sort of an analyst introduction a few months back. And this is an interesting thing. When I first heard about this, first thing that came to mind was Rackable Killer, which I think it's that segment that this is aimed squarely at. The Yahoos, companies like that that buy these servers by the thousands per week or per month. But all they really want, they're really looking at the ROI. Low power, low cost of acquisition. Their service model is some high school kid pulling out dead servers in the morning, sliding in new ones, then they send a pallet full of dead ones back to the manufacturer. There's not going to be any more service beyond that. And that's it's a big market. There's a lot of money being spent there, but it's not something that a traditional data center, IBM, HP, Dell, and Sun, they don't really hit those metrics yet. This box seems to do it. I was a little skeptical when I first heard about it before actually seeing anything that IBM would be able to stop themselves from putting on all the enterprise bells and whistles, but they did. And they've got a very, very dense, very inexpensive, and very efficient box here.
So, yeah, I mean, to date, Rackable's, anyone who follows the server market, you know that Rackable's taken Microsoft and Yahoo and Amazon and YouTube and some other big accounts, which is pretty impressive for a startup. And they've kind of done that in part by focusing on a compact design and low power and doing, I guess it's kind of like half width systems, really.
So
give us the actual the physical specifications on how iDataPlex is maybe different to that or exactly what's going on with the system. Can you talk about how it's marrying these two racks and why that matters?
It's, essentially two columns of racks. They are reduced, size in terms of width and depth. So they are, I believe we're talking about 19 inches, it's two 19-inch racks, but we're also about 18, 19 inches deep, so there's room at the back of the box. The whole rack will still fit in the same number of floor tiles. But by reducing the depth of each server, each motherboard, and doing two columns of them, it leaves you room for fans in the back. So they've got the whole back of the thing is fan basically, but you can get some really serious density in terms of CPUs. The other thing that they've done is put the power supplies and networking on their sides, so vertically between the columns, on each side of the columns and between the columns of servers. And that's a very efficient design. And again, it's something that you can reduce cost. You don't need to have this stuff hanging off the back somewhere. The thing that really impressed me in seeing this thing run, they had a full-up unit where we were. It was down in a lab in Raleigh. And they had their rear door heat exchanger that is tied into the track unit. So it gets chilled water from the crack unit, sends it through this door, sends it back out. Because this thing is a slightly different design, they have about 30% more radiator space on that back door. And what was incredible was to be at the front of the system and feel, you know, 75-degree air going in, then go to the back of the unit and feel it coming out about 65 degrees, very noticeably cooler than the ambient air in their data center.
Right. And, Chris, you...
That's something.
Yeah, I mean, they're pretty proud of their of the cooling unit there. Chris, you saw one of these systems at the Blade System Summit, but it wasn't the actual system. I understand.
Yeah, it was at Blade Systems Insight, and they had a cardboard mock-up of the system there. And it looks to me like it's kind of a system where they've converted a rack, a custom rack. They basically threw out the definition of what a rack is and made a custom rack that is essentially a Blade chassis, and these blades fit in to the rack like a Blade would in a Blade chassis, and they have shared power supplies and shared cooling, shared fans, just like the Blade systems do. But the thing it looks like they didn't really concentrate on is all the enterprise reliability and RAS features, you know, all the stuff.
Exactly.
Adds lots and lots of cost to the servers. Just like Dan said, it's so that they can compete against the white box vendors who've been, you know, kicking butt at the lower end of the market in the, you know, the mass web hosting and large web properties market. People like Yahoo and Google and Microsoft.
And I guess the cardboard edition is a little more power efficient than...
yeah. The cardboard edition is flammable, but it's very low power.
But it won't cool the rest of the room. I don't think you get any additional cooling out of that. It just tends to soak up the chilled water.
It was also very quiet.
And Chris, I think you had a couple questions here because I know you know Rackable well and the server market well. And so you were saying before the call that, you just had a couple questions maybe for Dan about what kind of motherboards you can slip in here.
So the idea is to be able to use the really low-cost commodity motherboards and not, you know, custom-designed versions that, you know, go in Blade servers or whatever that cost a lot. And
yep.
So my question, I asked Doug Balog of IBM about this, and I got a sort of answer, but I was wondering how many of the third-party motherboards have been certified for this thing. So, can you pick an Asus motherboard with an Intel or an AMD, you know, processor socket on it, or can you pick a Supermicro board or something like that and stick it in here? And the answer I got was, well, we'll be doing that in time, but I think right now the only thing that they have available is something from IBM. I don't know, but that's what I've led to believe.
And the answer, you know, some of this is going to become, we're going to discover in the fullness of time. But my understanding is that there are about 20, 22 different permutations. And when you say from IBM, it's coming from the same vendors that put this stuff together in Taiwan and various places like everybody else to keep the cost down.
So were you told who that was?
What's that?
Were you told who that was?
It's a variety of names, several names, all of them pretty big. The thing is, though, is that this kind of deal for these boxes is not the kind of thing where you need for instance, in the medium term or short term, you're not going to be able to – you're not going to see this on IBM's website. Only the biggest enterprise customers are going to probably be interested in buying it. This is not a mass market thing at all. So when they go into a Yahoo or somebody like that, they're going to sit down and talk custom. Not that it's going to be built from the ground up custom, but it's what's your thermal envelope? What's your processing? Yeah. What processing do you need, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? And I do know that the major processors, quad-core, dual-core, are available on this. Intel for sure, and I believe most AMDs. If not now, then they will be soon.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense, and that's why there's such a lack of detailed information on the website about this product.
Well, I think it officially goes on sale maybe. It was either June or July, so maybe they'll put a little more up by then.
Well, the other thing you got to remember, too, is that these are not going to be sold like blades at all. I mean, like a blade, you might buy a blade chassis at a time, half full, three quarters full. I would tend to think that the smallest unit this will be sold in is probably four or five full up racks.
Right.
That's just your selling quantity that gets filled in on the page.
And when you say, you were saying before it takes up the same amount of tile space, that's for two racks?
Well, it's one unit, but we would think of it looking at it that it's two racks because it's two columns of servers.
But is it the same width as a 19-inch rack? What I saw looked like just a standard 19-inch equipment rack, 6 foot tall, 19 inches wide. And it had, you know, what looked like just, you know, some high-density 1U servers in it. I mean, well, I didn't look super closely because I just didn't pay that much attention. But there's no dimensions on their website. So I got
some dimensions. If you're looking at this thing, it is essentially the same size as two 19-inch racks in terms of width.
Side by side.
But it's half the depth.
Right. Dan, I'm just wondering, you know, if customers are a little reticent to put unusual gear in there, you know, are they going to be willing to put in something that, even though it takes up about the same amount of space as, or the same amount of space as two racks, it's still unusual in that it's combined together?
I don't think that's really an issue. Essentially, it takes up two 19-inch rack units. It's just the only place where it varies on the size is in the depth, and it's about half the depth, so you can put two of these together. The other thing to keep in mind is that the vast majority of customers are going to buy these things in, you know, 10 racks at a time or entire row at a time, and it might actually be a positive in terms of getting those customers on board, because part of their ROI calculation is how much floor space does this thing take up.
All right. Well, maybe, you know, I think we've gone over the iDataPlex. It's interesting that IBM is doing that while Dell is also rolling out this cloud computing program they have where they build custom gear for kind of different verticals. If you're a search provider like ask.com, you can come to Dell and ask them to make you some motherboards with low power parts, and like we said before, throw out some of the redundant power supplies and everything, and Dell will do that for different verticals.
I don't know that this topic is all that much different than the iDataPlex thing.
Well, that's why, yeah, I was just kind of bringing it up that, you know, I talked to Dell's, the kind of three people who are in charge of this program, and I was actually pretty impressed. I mean, you look at Dell and IBM, I think they've definitely stepped it up here as far as they saw Rackable making a lot of money and they saw more demand coming from these service providers, and they've actually kind of taking care of it. You know, Dell has four systems that they make in-house that they've come up with. There's three servers that are a little more compact than usual, and there's a storage box that sounds almost like Sun's kind of Thumper system, where it's just a ton of disk with a Xeon front end. And then they also say, you know, they work with Supermicro and other guys in Taiwan to design boards as well. And, I mean, again, like you were saying with iDataPlex, you can't come in and order this off Dell's website. You have to be buying tens of thousands of systems to kind of make it worth Dell's while. But I guess once they do it for one vertical, then they use that system as the base for other customers.
Well, and the thing is it's not these companies coming to Dell or IBM and saying, hey, will you please design me a system? It's these companies saying, you know, we're going to buy 10,000 servers next month. If you guys are interested, here's what we're looking for in terms of floor space, heat, you know, TPM, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Here's the storage we want. Give it your best shot. And then they evaluate these things, the bids they get back, brutally. In one case that I was told about, if you're for every watt that your bid comes in above a competitor's low wattage design, you're penalized $7 per server. Your bid is. They're not kidding around, and they don't care about the stuff like we've been saying, the traditional RAS. It doesn't matter. Their RAS, they get through having thousands of these servers.
Chris, you know, as a server entrepreneur, I'm curious what you think about all this, because Dell tells me that this is worth their while, especially if they do a design like, say, for Ask, and then they're able to sell that to other. They've kind of done the hard work once, and then they're able to use that IP and sells systems to similar companies with similar needs. But I mean, when we're talking about these like 10,000 units and like Dan's saying, I mean, people are fighting over dollars per watt. You know, why are Dell and IBM catering to this market? It just seems even like it would be lower margin than your.
But it's a huge market. I mean, it's
volume.
It's the fastest growing, highest volume, largest part of the market right now is the, you know, the large web property market. And it's not just Google and Yahoo and Microsoft. You know, there's a hundred smaller web properties that are up and coming, and they're growing. You know, there's some of them are growing really fast, and they're looking for deals.
There's something else to look at in this too. Another two things I think are interesting here is I think that this, in some extent, is analogous to how HPC and commercial computing fit together, in that this stuff is the frontier of high density, low power, low heat, how to deal with all of those consequences. So I think it's valuable from that standpoint, over and above just having the sales volume. The other thing is that there are more and more workloads in large corporations that look like this. Anybody who's running, you know, you start to become a big business and you're running your own web stuff, this starts to become interesting. And I think that we might see that there are some business models emerging that will look, this will be a really good solution for. So again, kind of like how you see, starting to see more and more HPC in normal business, in parts of normal business, you're going to see more and more companies that take a look at this and say, hey, wait a minute, we've got power cooling problems. And if we look across the enterprise, we have 10,000 of these or can see the need for that. I think over time, you're going to see some more crossover.
Right.
Well, this is a good example of the hardware shaping the customer, and then the customer shaping the hardware again after, you know, so what happened was as CPU horsepower ran out of steam, people started scaling out and adding thousands of servers. And to do that, you have to write your software so that it can take advantage of scaling out. And by doing so, then you put yourself in the situation where you want to try and get the best, lowest cost scale out hardware you can. And then that's where now the vendors are starting to cater to that. So it's this kind of self-feeding loop, it's a feedback loop.
Any customer who doesn't give a crap about single server availability, this is something that will appeal to them when they start to get some size.
Well, don't ever say they don't give a crap, because they give a crap. They just don't want to pay for extra RAS features. If they could get all the RAS stuff, they would get it, but they just don't want to pay for it.
Well, I don't know that they would get it, because all that RAS stuff costs power, it costs floor space. It's not just that it costs more money to buy, it's more money to run, and it makes these things more complex.
A little bit, but the vendors aren't going to give it to them, because if they give it to the web properties, then they'll have to give it to their enterprise market too. So they're not going to give it away, because they still make great margin on that stuff on the enterprise market.
You know, there's kind of this interesting underlying theme to all of this, which is that a lot of people credit Google as, I guess, being the poster child for this move towards some of these new kinds of systems. But, you know, Google's so secretive that we have no idea if their approach to their data centers really saves them money. There's all this talk that, yeah, they get these custom boards from Intel, and this helps them save on power, and that's why they're doing all these things, is to save money on energy. But, I mean, it must make sense if all these other customers are coming to IBM and Dell. But what do you guys think about that? I mean, we have no idea really how efficient Google's data center is. Is it kind of funny that they're just...
Well, if it wasn't, they wouldn't be doing what they're doing, because they've got, you know, hundreds of people devoted to it, and they're spending a lot of money and time. So if it wasn't working, then they wouldn't be doing it. So you can rest assured that what they're doing is, you know, similar to this, but I'll bet you it's even more specific to their needs and is probably even more efficient than what something like this would do. Because IBM with the iDataPlex product is going to try and, you know, hit the sweet spot for as large or as broad a market as they can, whereas Google, they're designing for one customer themselves.
I'm skeptical, though. I mean, you know, we go through life, you say, well, I mean, Microsoft must know what they're doing. They're putting $1 billion into the next version of Windows. You know what I mean? And you look at Google.
And by the way, Intel, absolutely. They must have known what they were doing when they sunk how many billions into ASP centers?
Right. And I don't know. I'm curious. I wonder if Google gets more credit maybe than they deserve. There's really no way to know, I suppose, and they're building something that suits their needs. But I look at Google throwing around money on all kinds of sponsorships and you know, all these different projects that never really pan out. And I wonder if this might come back to haunt them at some point when the growth slows down and times get a little leaner. They can still be such kind of independent rebels with their data centers, or if maybe they'll have to dial it back a little bit.
I think right now they're using it as a weapon, and it's a very effective weapon.
And it looks like Microsoft is going to counter a little bit with trying out the containers on a really big scale at this new data center in Chicago. It's kind of funny because Rackable and Sun have been doing the containers, and it seemed to be plodding along. There's only a couple customer win announcements here and there. But then the Register, we just broke a story that, you know, Dell is doing a container now as well, and it seems like the Dell design might specifically be for that Microsoft center. I don't think they've won the deal, but I think they're trying to get in there. What do you guys make? It seems like the container it's official and it's taken off now. IBM's going to do iDataPlex containers.
Yeah, it's funny. It's one of these things, like so many trends we see. One vendor comes up with something, everybody else makes fun of it up until about 2 weeks before they announce their own. And I haven't seen a lot of sales volume or particularly a lot of demand. I think that, first of all, it's not all that hard to do, especially when you have a lot of form factors to play around with, and that companies like IBM and HP kind of have already had this thing for years, because when you're the kind of company that'll go out and do like the U.S. Open or something like that, you've got to move a lot of gear. And it's only going to be there for a little bit. So they've sort of had these things informally. And I think it's interesting that we're all jumping on the bandwagon. I'm actually looking at doing a research thing for my company. I'm going to put everything into a van and then just drive around doing in-field research at customer locations.
You're building a data center in a van, or you're just going site?
Yes, it's going to be a complete, total Gabriel Consulting Group, urban or rural research vehicle.
I like it.
Humvee? Yeah. You're going to get an old VW bus?
I'm thinking, though, given the tax, I'm going to try and bump that up a little bit, because I'm going to be living in it, eating and breathing. I go to a customer site, going to do some research, whatever. All I need from you, Mr. Customer, is an outlet and a hose and perhaps a storm drain.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that, because last week at the Blade Center, Blade Systems Insight Conference, the keynote was a guy from the NFL who manages the NFL's computing infrastructure. And his story was exactly what you just said, which was, you know, most of their heavy duty work is done out in the field, and they ship a lot of hardware around. And they're using IBM's Blade Center products for most of it. But they provide all kinds of in-the-field services, you know, especially like when they do the Super Bowl. It's like a month and a half on the ground in another city somewhere. And they have to basically set up a whole working data center to service all the media, the teams, the fans, the NFL management, everything. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been perhaps a bit too breathless about all you talked about jumping on the bandwagon, Dan, because the readers definitely smacked me around on the Dell story, and they were saying that I guess, you know, DEC had one of these like 15 or 20 years ago, the same basic thing. It's one of those things where, like you're saying, Dan, I mean, people do this,
yeah.
And that's what they claimed. I really got slapped around. They're like, this is like 20 years old. This is, you know, no big deal. But I think that kind of missed the point, that it's definitely returning again and everyone's jumping on it pretty hard now.
Everything goes around in circles.
Yeah. But I mean,
it'll be interesting to see who and how much money is actually spent on these things.
Right. Well, Microsoft's buying up to 220, I think. So, I mean, that's based
of
on
whose?
Of, well, that's
of Dell?
No, according to my information, and I think it's quite accurate this time around. The RFP...
Is this a scoop?
Yeah, well, I wrote about this in the Dell story. The RFP came out. It is a scoop, though. Was for the last week of April, so I don't think they've decided yet. So as far as I understand it, Rackable's done a design. The Dell container is specifically for this Microsoft bid, but presumably Dell could then sell it afterwards. I'm sure Sun, you would think, is in this, although what I heard was that Sun didn't even get a chance to submit a proposal, which is kind of interesting. And maybe Ferrari's there, although there's kind of problems with the Ferrari design. You have to, like, run it on top of I forget how it works, but because of the cooling, you have to kind of run it on top of a platform. And so it's mostly...
And have space above.
Right, so it's mostly designed for kind of outdoor use, I think. So it might come down to Rackable and Dell, and whoever wins that one is going to be sitting pretty, because that data center, by the sounds of it, has to be somewhere between $300 and $400 million.
But
that's amazing.
The thing is, when you start talking about that, you're taking a design that is designed to be mobile. At what point do you decide that, why don't we just throw up a metal building around this thing?
Well,
and
it's not really. Well, that's, I would argue that it's not really designed to be mobile so much as it is designed to be modular, so that you can plug them together like Lego blocks to build your data center. So I don't think anybody's thinking about trailering these things around more than once, right?
Well,
I mean, they're just going to take it out there, plop it down, and plug it in.
I think there's two scenarios. I think Chris is totally on with what Microsoft is doing, which is they have no intention of making this mobile. I mean, this is just outfitting a data center with tons of these containers arranged in the most efficient way. But as far as, like, if you're the military or you're a lab, I mean, it does...
Yeah, but we haven't heard any uptake in those markets yet. The only ones I've heard about are, you know, Wall Street banks putting them on the roof, or, some web company in California putting one in the back parking lot inside of a chain link fence with its own generator, you know, and this Microsoft thing.
Well, we wouldn't hear about the DoD ones, though.
No, and some of those, I haven't heard, or maybe I've missed it, but I haven't seen anything where, for instance, Wall Street is putting these things on roofs, perhaps a pilot project, but actually putting them up there permanently and paying for them. I haven't heard that. It may have happened, but I haven't heard about it. And then the other thing, it seems the example of putting these things out in a vacant lot, putting a chain link fence around it and a generator, I don't know. I'm thinking you could probably get better TCO with a building.
But isn't that I think Sun announced the Stanford Linear Accelerator as one of its paying customers.
Yeah.
And I thought that's what they did, is just kind of shoved it out back and fired it up. Yeah.
And they said, we're upgrading, and upgrading means they bring in a new box and plop it down next to the old one.
Right. It was a second box.
Yeah.
So, it just seems like we're still in that experimental phase. So maybe people are all doing different things, and maybe.
Yeah, I think it would be really cool if you made those boxes more structural than they are, and built them so that you could, basically pin them together like Lego blocks and build a wall out of them.
But if you
like build a building out of data center containers, that inside it is contained all of your office space.
Yeah, but the only problem is then you have
to put a roof on it.
You have to get craned up to go into the
imagine how much.
Well, you'd have to have two openings, one for a fire exit.
Imagine how much Rust-Oleum you're going to need to spray that bad boy with on the outside.
Yeah,
to keep it from rusting up over the winter.
No different than any other commercial building, though. It's going to be exposed to the weather.
It's a whole new job added to the admin's task. You have to,
you get one of those old rusting hulks out there in the East Bay, one of those old ships, and you cut out all the structure and you just fill it up with these containers and let it float in the water. What a great concept! It's not susceptible to earthquakes or flooding or anything else.
Anyone who builds that gets a registered
a barge,
T-shirt.
There you go.
Yeah.
Free registered T-shirt for anyone who builds that.
Well, you've got your water to water.
You're so generous.
Yeah, that's very big of him.
Well, this is good.
You're sure to get a write up though. That's for sure.
Man, anyone who does a barge, you will get a barge data center. Will get a large
data barge.
Plenty of ink in the register. Absolutely.
And another t-shirt for the best name for it.
So, you know, I think actually those were kind of the major hardware topics I wanted to cover this week. There was just one more dabbling in the software realm was Citrix and VMware both reported their earnings a couple of weeks ago, and we see VMware still up around $400 million a quarter, and Citrix broke out ZenSource, and I think it was around $5 million a quarter, or $5 million in the last quarter for ZenSource. So
it's not a lot.
What is it? Yeah, that's not, you know, it's still a young market and all that, but it's not looking terribly competitive from where I'm sitting.
Pretty good for starting it free, right?
Yeah.
No, not really.
I mean, well, they do have stuff to sell around it.
Hey, you know what I think? You know what I think goes here? I think this is a case of, like people used to say, nobody ever got fired for buying IBM. I think it's the same thing with VMware. VMware right. has developed a reputation where now nobody's going to get fired for buying VMware, but ZenSource is still kind of, well, is it open source or is it commercial? You know, there's just still some question around it.
And Dan, I know you were impressed. I remember you being impressed when you went to Microsoft's kind of analyst day about what they're doing with Hyper-V, but I mean, realistically, would it, obviously it's the full weight of Microsoft behind this thing, so you'd expect them to do better than Citrix here, and they have the advantage of kind of bundling it in the OS, but I mean, really, what do you think? ZenSource has been at this for a while, and we're only up to 5 million.
See, that's very troubling. I mean, I think that like any good market, you need to have competitors out there, and in x86 virtualization, the competition just isn't there, right? And as we can see from the numbers here, it's still not there. Microsoft, of course, is going to shake that up quite a bit. What I was impressed with at their management conference is that they finally seem to get it, and they understand a bit more why this whole virtualization thing is happening. And where the previous feeling I had is that they thought virtualization was happening just for people to get out of paying for multiple Microsoft licenses, just a way of personally spiting Microsoft. But there are real customer needs that this addresses. They understand that now. And while I think the easy thing is going to be able to say when Hyper-V comes out, well, you know, it doesn't have vMotion. It doesn't have this, it doesn't have that, so it's not a competitor. The thing is, it's going to be very well integrated. It is going to be inexpensive, and we're sworn to secrecy on anything beyond that, but it will be a price performer. Well, and
I thought they'd already put out the price. I mean, wasn't it like $28 or something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, it's low. It's
is
like
that public now?
Bucks.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. They,
28, 28 is the number I have.
I mean, and, so it's like a sandwich. It's like a steak.
Well, the thing is, and I asked the question, okay, $28, why not $29 or $27? And it turns out that number was very, very closely looked at because it needs to be clear that they're not giving it away with the operating system.
Yeah, it's an antitrust thing.
There you go. And
so what, 28 is the magic antitrust number?
28, not 27, not 29. It's 28 is the magic number from now on. But the thing that is going to be interesting, and the pattern we're going to see, is will a customer trade off things like vMotion in order to get a solution that gets you most of the way there with a promise to getting the rest of the way there soon and only pay $28 as opposed to what's VMware now? $3,000 a socket,
right?
Maybe $2,500 socket.
But I mean, what 28's like the base? That's like for hyper to turn Hyper-V on, more or less, right?
Yeah, I think it's a little more than that, but it is the base. But I don't think that the full blown gets near, you know, $3,500 a socket.
Or VMware. Well, there's no question. Like I've heard, VMware's already heavily discounting to keep customers. So without question, VMware is going to have some pricing pressure and already is. But, I mean, dear Lord, ZenSource was free, man.
Well, that's the thing. The analysts at the Blade Systems Insight conference last week are all predicting that the cost of the hypervisor is basically going to go to zero and it's going to be other value add products that are what they're making their revenue
and
on.
Once you get to that, who has value add products? VMware. I mean, the other guys barely have anything to offer you.
Well, right now, today, yeah. If you're looking at it, you know, ZenSource versus VMware versus SWSoft, but look at things that are on the drawing board with like HP, IBM. All of their management products have built-in tools to manage VMs and VM sprawl. So the hypervisor becomes a commodity, but everything that manages it above and above becomes value add, and it becomes a point of differentiation.
So, Dan, I mean, you're saying when you're talking about the pressure VMware faces, though, are you talking about like in the coming year, or this is like 2-3 years on? Because it just seems like the other guys to get all those management products out is going to take some time.
It's in the coming year, I think. There's just going to be an immense amount of pressure that's going to start up later this fall, and we're going to see the hypervisor commoditize pretty quickly, the next year, 18 months. But with diminishing margins all throughout as we go down that chain. And at the same time, I mean, there's trying to think of who doesn't already have VMware hooks in their management suites. I think pretty much everybody does on the server side.
Right.
And then being able to tie up something that VMware doesn't do very well is to be able to tie that management up beyond the virtual machines, but to the applications and to business rules and to business policies. That's something VMware doesn't do very well, and that's something that pretty much everybody else, and including Microsoft to an extent, they get that. They understand that.
Right. Hey, before we close out, Chris, do you have anything you can publicly share on D-Wave, the kind of quantum computing company that you work closely with?
We'll have some interesting news in the next probably month or so.
How many?
We're plugging away. We have 28 qubits today.
That's still what I was going to ask. 28. Okay.
Isn't that a major for just, a North Arc?
Yeah. Yep. But you know, the company is you know, moving along very rapidly, and we're hopefully gonna have I think 512 is what we're shooting for by the end of the year, and then that'll still be a prototype system, and we hope to sell the first systems towards the end of next year.
So remind me again, I mean, how many qubits do you need then to be kind of a viable commercial?
Well, see, that's the thing that not many people know the answer to, because it depends on the type of problem you're solving. You know, there are some people that say that if you had 100 or 200 fully connected qubits, and all qubits are created differently, they're not equal, that you would be able to solve, you know, some really challenging problems. The type of system that we're building, it looks like it's going to take, 1,000 to 2,000 qubits before we're able to really outpace classical systems by an order of magnitude, which is, you know, what we want to be able to do, because this is not a cheap, not an inexpensive machine to build.
And without getting too controversial or involved, or maybe this is a bad road to go down, but who's this guy who gives D-Wave such a hard time?
I don't even know if I want to mention his name.
there's a guy. What? He's like a computer scientist.
Oh yeah, he's a math guy at MIT. His name is Scott Aronson. Everybody's read his articles. He's constantly lampooning D-Wave.
So this guy,
but he gives us great press.
I was going to say, but this guy just has a bee in his bonnet about yeah, quantum computing.
He's definitely got an axe to grind. I don't know why, but there's something about him. In his last article, it was probably only about 6 paragraphs. In that 6 paragraphs, he mentioned D-Wave 17 times.
We'll see. All press is good press.
Yeah, that's what I say.
Unless it's at the register and really mean.
Or in a restroom in a Minneapolis airport.
So to answer your question, things are going really well. It's moving forward. The company is well-funded.
Sorry to cut you off there at the end, Chris. We just get a little static. But it sounds like D-Wave is rolling along really well. And with that, I just want to wrap up the show and thank you guys for your time. And as always, thank our listeners for tuning in. You can send me email to ashley.fans@theregister.co.uk or jump into the comments section. And anyone who leaves questions, I'll try and get them answered. We're up to about 7,000 listeners on a couple of the more popular shows, so I really appreciate everybody tuning in. And again, if there's any topics you want me to cover in the future or people you want interviewed, let me know and I will do my best. And thanks again to Dan and Chris. See you guys in a couple of weeks.